Senate Energy and Utilities Policy and Finance Committee. It's Tuesday, March 1st, at approximately 3:04 in the afternoon. The year's 2022, and we've got a couple of bills before us and a confirmation hearing, and we're going to alter the agenda just a little bit since Weber's here with his, Senator Weber's here with his witnesses. I think we'll hear him first, and so Senator Weber, we're going to hear Senate File 3066, pardon me, 3060. When you're ready, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And also, there is a delete all amendment, the A1 amendment.
Okay, there's an A1 amendment, but somebody moved the A1 amendment. Senator Matthews moved the A1 amendment. Any discussion on it? If not, all in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, and the amendment's on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to point out the amendment, the purpose of that was to make it crystal clear that the bill only affects the commercial pace, not residential pace. There was some question as to whether the original bill was specific enough, and this bill then, I believe, satisfies the needs and the requests of those who were concerned about that. It also places definitions of farmland and water conservation in the commercial pace statute, and additionally moves water conservation and farmland definitions from the definition of energy measures to their own section. And so with those changes in place, Mr. Chairman and members, I'm very happy to bring to you Senate File 3060 as amended. Minnesota's Property Assessed Clean Energy, or PACE program, has provided low-cost financing for over 350 clean energy projects and resulted in about $255 million of investment over the years. This has reduced energy costs for these projects as well as produced positive environmental impacts. Currently, agricultural producers can only use PACE for the installation of solar panels. And this bill would expand the use of PACE funds to include for permanent farmland improvements, such as drainage and irrigation systems with holding ponds as appropriate, grading or leveling of land, soil improvements, tree crops, and fencing and water systems for actively managed grazing, just to name a few. Certainly farmers have experienced a lot of impacts these recent years, whether it's too much rain, whether it's too little rain, and certainly there is a need at times to provide them some positive cash flow as they look at diminishing bottom lines. Currently, the high inflation that we are seeing on a national level has created some serious issues in the farming community. We see a doubling of fertilizer costs. We see substantial increases in chemical and seed costs. And producers need additional tools to help improve the resiliency of their assets, that being their land, and protect their businesses while they attempt to provide the necessary product for the global food supply. And I believe that this bill will help in that regard. Minnesota has always demonstrated leadership in agricultural innovation, and I think this bill will allow that to help that continue. And as farmers consider new options to improve, as I mentioned before, not only their productivity, but protect their most valuable asset, their land. So thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I have, with your permission, Mr. Chairman, I have two testifiers here today, Mr. Klein from the St. Paul Port Authority, Mr. Schmidt from Cargill, and I will let them introduce themselves and their support for this bill.
Okay, whoever wants to start, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, senators.
Snuggle up to the microphone a little bit. As close as you can.
A little closer. Yeah, perfect. My name is Peter Klein. I am the Vice President of Finance for the St. Paul Port Authority. And several years ago, the Department of Commerce asked us to take on PACE throughout the state of Minnesota, and I said I would take that on with a couple of caveats, one of which was that we would require lender acknowledgement in every one of our cases. So if there's a mortgage on the property, the mortgage holder needed to approve the PACE assessment as well as the property owner. So in all of our 350 plus projects, we have received that lender acknowledgement. I know this statute, this bill would put it in statute that we would require mortgage holder acknowledgement and consent, but that's the way we've operated from the beginning. The $225 million of projects, 350 projects puts us third in the nation behind California and Ohio. So we're a very successful program and have saved a significant amount of energy throughout the state and producing a lot of energy. The projects range from a biotech manufacturer in Austin to a hotel in Albert Lea to a hotel in International Falls, actually, and from a restaurant in Ely to a housing project in Laverne. So we are truly statewide and probably have projects in your districts. Cargill approached us to see if farmland enhancements could qualify for PACE, and that's why we're here. We feel that PACE is a good financing mechanism. It's not mandatory. It's simply an option for farmers to use. Other states have used PACE to finance other areas other than energy. So examples are California uses it for seismic retrofits, Florida for hurricane preparedness. And nationally, the national organization, PACE Nation, is looking to us to really help with farmland agricultural enhancements. And I'll let Matt from Cargill speak to the projects that he would envision.
Mr. Schmidt, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
I'm sorry, what was that, Mr. Chairman?
Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself.
Perfect, thank you. Hi there, I'm Matt Schmidt, Mr. Chairman and members. It's an honor to be before you today. I'm part of a team at Cargill that is looking at ways that we can help farmers remain resilient and successful in the face of the increasingly erratic weather and market conditions that we see in the headlines every day. And there are a lot of options out there for farmers as they look at ways that they can bring their operations kind of in line with the realities that they face. And yet we saw a gap in some of the longer term opportunities here. What we have in agricultural improvements are many kind of long term low risk projects that can make a lot of sense for investment. But in current structures today, those opportunities are not incentivized, or they're hard to take advantage of, or they're more costly than really they might otherwise be. And so just like PACE financing in energy has catalyzed investment in low risk, really sensible projects through utilizing private capital in this innovative mechanism with private landowners, so we see an opportunity to extend that to farmland. We're really excited to bring this forward, especially in a state like Minnesota, where there is so much innovative PACE work happening now. I hear all the time from Pete that folks call him to figure out how he's able to execute so many projects. And so we're excited to continue to advance the use of this great program, and we see a lot of opportunities. So with that, would love to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions? I'm going to just start with the first one. Mr. Klein, could you give us a 1 minute dissertation on PACE and how it works, the property assessed clean energy program? Okay, what are the dynamics of it? How does it work for us and for our viewing audience, if you will?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to do that. PACE is a special assessment on property, just like a street and gutter assessment. It is a special assessment on the property. It differs a little bit from the street and gutter in that the property owner, it's a unique assessment to the property owner, and the property owner is requesting it. Generally, the first payment of the assessment is May 15th of the following year with the property taxes. The advantage that creates a great advantage. That delayed payment allows energy savings to be realized and really makes these investments immediately positive cash flow. So our objective is to finance 100% of the project and have the cost the repayment of the PACE assessment to be something less than the energy savings or energy production if it's a renewable energy project. But it is a voluntary assessment, and we're limited in a couple of areas. In Minnesota, we're limited to 20% of the assessed value of the property, or if there's a current appraisal, we can go up to 20% of the appraised value. And we're limited to 20 years on the assessment payments. So the statute is fairly simple in Minnesota, and it's very effective. It's very effective.
Thank you very much. Senator Frenz.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Weber, for bringing the bill forward. Mr. Klein, one of the justifications here talks about helping farmers deal with extreme weather patterns and events. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, it is.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
First of all, members of the committee, this goes back to our topic from our last meeting. Part of the charge of this committee, I think, is to take into account climate change and the need to decarbonize, and we're here hearing a bill for which farmers are now being asked to address that. So I ask members of the committee to keep this stuff in mind as these bills go forward. My colleague, Senator Matthews, pointed out there are things that we can reasonably predict in the future, and I'm drawing the committee's attention to this as one of the results of things that we didn't change 20, 30 years ago. I plan to support the bill, Senator Weber. But my other question, Mr. Chair, and I guess Mr. Klein maybe, is you mentioned the other states that had made choices that were not directly related to energy efficiency. I thought you mentioned Florida, California. Do you mind saying a little bit more about the justification for those programs and how they got involved?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Other states have added an R to the PACE acronym, so resiliency. So Washington, state of Washington, Tennessee. Others have seen that PACE can be utilized to help in other areas other than just energy production or energy reduction. The largest PACE projects in the country, I think, were the seismic retrofits in California. And so they're, as far as dollar amount, they're way ahead of us. But those are just examples. Other states have used PACE in other areas. So in Oklahoma, it's tornado readiness. So specific areas need to be addressed in their state. So as those came about, the delayed payment, and so the investment and that the payment is delayed so that you can start seeing some of the benefits of your investment before you need to be making the payment, that's really one of the attractive points of PACE.
Senator Frenz?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Klein. Again, thank you, Senator Weber, for bringing the bill forward.
Great. Anyone else around the table? Questions? Sensing none, any concluding comments? Senator Weber?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity to have this bill heard. I believe it provides a great opportunity for the farming community to have another avenue by which they can finance these type of improvements to their land, and I appreciate your support of this bill. Thank you.
Great. So, members, the motion would be a recommendation that Senate File 3060, 3060 pass, and my understanding is it can go right to the floor if that's okay with you, Senator Weber. And
fine.
Would somebody move that particular motion? Senator Eric moves it. Any discussion? No discussion. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Aye.
Opposed, nay, and the bill is carries.
Thank you.
Amended.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. Senator Matthews, would you take the floor? We're going to hear the next bill.
All right, members, next we'll hear Senate File 3225 from Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 3225, rather, is probably the simplest bill I've ever had before a committee, but nonetheless, they all count. And it's simply a bill that has to do with a threshold dollar amount which might go before the Public Utilities Commission for approval. Relative to a sale, a lease, a plant improvement, I believe, of any type. And, Mr. Chair, I think I'll just leave it there. And Senator, or pardon me, Mr. Evans is here by me as my witness, and he can maybe portray this in a little more detail. But I would move, by the way, Mr. Chair, that on line 1.9, after the word of, it's deleted, as you note, $100,000 is deleted, and we insert into that $2 million. By the way, go ahead.
Senator Senjum moves an oral amendment on line 1.9, deleting $100,000 and deleting the blank appropriation and inserting $2 million.
And Mr. Chair, that motion is just made on the basis of the fact this hasn't been upgraded, I believe, since 1974, or a very, very long time ago.
All right. Any discussion to that motion, members? Seeing none, all those in favor of the oral amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The oral amendment is adopted. Mr. Evans, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As Senator Senjum mentioned, the law was passed in 1974 that required utilities to seek approval from the Public Utilities Commission for the sale or purchase of an asset exceeding $100,000 in value. And, of course, this is important to the Public Utilities Commission because those assets, an asset sale, a large asset sale or purchase, will have an impact on rates, and this is sort of a pre-approval of some of those purchases. But for a company the size of ours and the size of our business, $100,000 is now a pretty small amount. We can sell transformers and bucket trucks for $100,000, and that's not something that's, first of all, going to have an impact on our rates, and not something that we think the PUC or Xcel Energy regulatory staff needs to spend a lot of time on. So, we would propose changing the threshold so that this would be so that fewer of these matters would have to go before the Public Utilities Commission. Again, this does not have an impact on our customers' rates, and of course, all of these purchases and sales would subsequently have to be approved through a rate case before they would be included in our rate base. So it's not as if the PUC has no review over these sales and purchases. As we've talked with stakeholders, I think there is some concern about whether $2 million is the right amount, and some concern about whether the $2 million should apply to a large utility like ours as compared to a small utility. And as I testified earlier today in the other body, you know, we're absolutely open to sitting down with the stakeholders and trying to find a consensus on what would be the right dollar to put in here, and perhaps maybe different dollars for different utilities. So our purpose here is to seek a consensus and bring peace in the valley before the bill is finally done, and that's what we've pledged to do.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. So if I'm doing the math right, at a jump at this rate, the next time you come to the legislature to change this will be $40 billion that you'll be with a factor of 20.
Let's see, 1974 until now, it won't be me, I'll tell you that.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Evans. Our next testifier that we have, who I'm told is online, Ms. Levinson-Falk. Are you on the Zoom screen somewhere?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, Ms. Levinson-Falk, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and then feel free to begin.
Thank you, Chair Matthews and members. My name is Annie Levinson-Falk, and I'm the Executive Director of the Nonprofit Citizens Utility Board. I've been asked for Cubs thoughts on this bill as a consumer advocate, both in the Senate and the House, and so I thought it might be helpful to testify on the record. Thank you for letting me share some thoughts today, and thank you especially for making remote testimony possible, as it was a little tough for me to get to the cities today. I agree that an update to the statute certainly makes sense. A utility shouldn't have to have every $100,000 transaction approved by the PUC, and it's not a good use of the PUC's time or anybody else's time to be micromanaging utilities at that level. The question, of course, is just what is the appropriate threshold? This bill is at 2 million. The House is at 500,000 this morning. So I understand there's still some discussion going on about that. And I don't know if Xcel or other utilities have specific plans where this threshold might come into play, but I think about it in terms of what it might mean for customers. As Mr. Evans said, Xcel, being by far the largest utility in the state, can absorb a pretty large purchase without it making it an impact on their customers' bills. But that's not true of some of the smaller utilities. And I've looked at it as a kind of a percentage of the utility's annual revenues. Or another way of saying that is how much would rates go up to account for a purchase of that size if it were to be passed on to customers in a year? So if the threshold increased to 500,000, it'd be a minuscule rate increase for Xcel. On the other end of the scale, you have Otter Tail Power, which is the state's smallest public utility. At $500,000 would be about 0.25% of a rate increase for Otter Tail. $2 million for Otter Tail equates to about a 1% rate increase, just shy of that. So it does get to be somewhat substantial. And as I said, I certainly agree increasing the threshold for approval makes sense. And as the bill moves forward and the threshold level is determined, I just encourage you to keep in mind the impact that it might have on customers, and particularly the different scale of impact it have for different for utilities of different sizes. And I've spoken with Xcel a little bit and others about some ways to maybe take that into account. And I'd be happy to talk further if I might be of help in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Levitson-Falk. So Senator Senjum, do you have any follow-up? I guess question should be asked what the path will be for this bill and if there's going to be future discussions and figuring out if this is the right number or if it's going to be adjusted, when that decision will be made with this bill. So, Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would suggest the suggested path here today would be to recommend approval of this bill and send it to the floor. And of course, between now and whenever it gets to the floor, there can certainly be conversation about this and amended language on the floor. This is a pretty simple amendment, obviously, and so we can have that. And of course, there's a conference committee later on to which this can be addressed if it needs to be. So I think there's opportunities, certainly along the path, if you will, to further study, take further input into this, and try to find the right number.
Any questions or discussion from committee members? Seeing none, and I don't see any online. Anything in closing, or do you want to move your bill, Senator Senjum?
Nothing in closing, Mr. Chair. I would just recommend then that Senate File 3225, as amended, be recommended to pass and move to the floor.
All right. On Senator Senjum's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no. Motion carries.
Chair. I hope this is not my phone. Yeah. Thought I turned it off, but.
Okay, we're going to now move into the, if you will, the confirmation hearing for Mr. John Tuma as a member of the Public Utilities Commission. The governor appointed you at some point a couple of months ago. believe we were in session, actually.
It's about last year,
actually. Until this session, and so we're going to do that today. And welcome to the committee, Mr. Tuma. Do you have some opening statements? And I'm sure the committee will probably have some questions for the follow-up.
As always
welcome
is questions.
Welcome and proceed as you wish.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name for the record is John Tuma. I'm from the beautiful township of Bridgewater, just west of the city of Northfield. And, you know, actually, it almost seems kind of trivial to be here when you watch things that are happening in Ukraine and coming in front of you and asking you to be a public servant when you see the sacrifices that are being made in that country for freedom and liberty and to be able to have their own democracy. So it kind of pales to come in front of you and ask you to continue my public service. I realize that it is a huge a task that I have, but it's nowhere near the task that the people of Ukraine are feeling. So my heart goes out to them, but we are here, and it, understand, the commission does, the potential that that conflict could have on gas prices and on our utility bills. And so I appreciate the leadership that we've had from Chair Sieben and from other commissioners to keep an eye on these things, and we're going to watch them very closely. We recognize that the price of natural gas is a significant role in this whole process. I just want to assure you that we're keeping a very close eye on what that impact would be. But thank you. I deeply appreciate the opportunity to be in front of you today. I was both honored and humbled by Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan's trust in having me to continue my service on the commission. Don't let the blue suit fool you. I am a Republican, and I'm a proud Republican. I still involved in my local Republican politics. I've been a delegate to my county convention for the last now 3 decades. I'm looking for a good candidate to run in the open seat down there in 58 that we've just encompassed. So we're excited about that. I kind of find it fun that actually District 58 was the number that my former law partner and good friend Dave Thompson had here about 6 years ago. Now he's down in North Carolina enjoying the nice weather, but it's exciting to be there and kind of this change going on. I know that there's a lot of buzz around that. But I think the governor appointed me to the commission because of the fact that I have been able to work across party lines, both in my career as a legislator and as a lobbyist. I really found ways to bring people together to move Minnesota forward. Even though I'm a Republican, I'm a Minnesotan first. And I take it very seriously, my role on the commission, to be cooperative, bipartisan, and working with my colleagues to find paths forward. Very much like this committee, Mr. Chair, I think you folks have demonstrated quite well that you work together in this highly partisan air. You got some great things done. And that's one of the things I just kind of wanted to just highlight for you. Sometimes we don't pay attention to the good news. Everybody talks about the bad news around utility bills and everything, but I kind of want to just highlight some of the good work you've done, made our job easier over at the PUC. And I'll start with my friends of the commission always hate it because I love history. On Friday of this week, the Public Utility Commission will be 151 years old. We are one of the longest agencies in the state of Minnesota. We started out as the Railroad and Warehouse Commission, and Senator French, you'll be interested to know that the governor who pushed that strongly was from your district, Governor Horst Austin from St. Peter. And there was a reason somebody from St. Peter was worried about these railroad monopolies. They were worried about their ability to pick who's going to be the winning hardware store, the winning grain elevator, the winning grocery store. There was a lot of economic power that was in these railroads at the time. And one of the foundations that Governor Austin and the legislature at that time recognized that there should never be, when you have a powerful kind of monopolistic government, preferential rates, preferential treatment. And that the focus of those legislations early on was to make sure our rates treated everybody equally, and that whatever your class contributed to the cost of that railroad, your class should also pay for, whether you were just a typical residential customer or you're a business. That was the foundation. A lot of people pass over that nowadays, but when we do a rate case, that's one of the things that we work the hardest on. Once we figured out how much the utility needs to run their operation, we spend a lot of time figuring out what is the responsibility for the residential class? What is the responsibility for the commercial class or large industrial? And I believe Darren put in your packet a little bit of a chart breakdown, and this is kind of the good news that I want to highlight for you. A lot of people spend time talking about how bad our rates are, but here's a good highlight for you that in Minnesota, you see that our average electric rate, we're actually just behind Wisconsin and just below the national average. And you think, oh, that's bad. But how many of you, when you get your utility bill, the first thing you go look at, back on page 2, hidden in the chart, what your rate is, okay? What's the first thing you look at? You look at your bill. And here's where Minnesota's success, and this is a success story that you should be proud of, and that is Minnesota's average utility electric bill for residents is the lowest in the Midwest, by far. We whoop them all, North Dakota, all of them, Wisconsin, everybody. We're far better than they are. We're actually, as you can see, we're fourth in the nation behind Colorado, Utah, and New Mexico, which, by the way, are high plains states, and they don't have as much electric demand as, say, a Midwest state who is a little more humid and a little bit more cold than they do down in the lovely state of New Mexico. And so we're doing really well. This is something you should put in your hat. And the reason why is this. We have built into our system a attitude about conservation. Remember the Conservation Enhancement Program that this legislature has pushed, the commission has pushed, the department has pushed, across all different independent governors, Republican governors, Democratic governors. There's been a mindset in Minnesota that we want to work with our residential folks to get their actual bills down by making sure their houses are more efficient refrigerators, more efficient washing machines, are sealed up better. And as a result, when you go to a rate case and you start figuring these things out, because our ratepayers' residential class is so efficient, okay, when we divvy up the cost, and that's the first thing we do after we determine how much, let's say a hypothetical $100 million utility for a year, we call it the test year, their revenue requirement, we have to divvy it up that between the different classes. And every one of the class cost of service studies has in it a element of how much energy you use. And when you have a very efficient residential class, they're going to play a proportional share less. Okay? This is something you should be proud of, okay? We've built into our system this culture of conservation. Our utilities should be proud of it. You, as the leaders in our policymaking, should be proud of it. This is something that's good. Now, I also know that some of you are sitting there going, wait a minute, I got the large industrials always telling me our rates are terrible in Minnesota, okay? They would probably say Tuma's cherry-picking a good number to show you, to make himself look good. Well, they would be right. I am cherry-picking a good number, okay? This is something you should be proud of, okay? It's a pretty good-looking cherry that you should go back, and it's a story that a lot of people don't tell you, the good story of the work that we've been doing. But here's where the story gets better, okay? And I think this is something you should be proud of, the work you've done recently. Senator Rarick, I told him I was going to give him a little praise, hoping it would be a little easier on me, but when you look at the ECO Act, okay, what does the ECO Act do? Instead of just saying, let's burn less energy, let's burn energy that is beneficial, like putting in heat pumps, like figuring out other things where we're now going to raise the amount of electricity going through that residential class. And guess what happens when you do that? Okay, once that gets baked into our system, the bills for our residential folks are going to go up. Their share of the revenue requirement is going to go up, thereby reducing the share that has to be provided by large industrials and the commercial class. And so once the ECO Act and some of the other good things you did about electrification start getting baked into the system, we're going to have a win-win, because I'm not going to be bothered by my utility bill going up because my energy costs in whole should go down. That's the goal of the ECO Act. And our large industrials are going to be happy because now we have a residential class that's going to be picking up more of the responsibility. These are the positive things that I see happening at the legislature. Take the Natural Gas Innovation Act. That was also another great, good bipartisan piece of legislation we're excited to be implementing up at the commission and working hard to do. And so that's why I want to seek reappointment, Mr. Chairman. I think it's the good work that you've laid out, policy work that you folks have laid out for us. It's an exciting transition time. I'm excited to be there. I've always told people when they come in front of us and want us to do something that's a little extra legislatively or extra legally, that we're not going to do it. We follow the law. It's the rule of law, and I always tell them I'm the handmaiden of the legislature. I'm going to do your work, and you've been doing good work, and I'm excited to continue to do it. Unfortunately, Mr. Chair, I'm kind of an ugly handmaiden, so you'll probably put me in the back room, but I will do my best to do the good policy work that you guys have set up and do it in a bipartisan way, even though I'm a Republican, okay? I also recognize that first and foremost, I'm a Minnesotan, and I think we have a good story to tell. We have a lot of work to do, and we're going to continue to do it, so I'm excited to make that transitional work. Mr. Chair, with that, your ugly handmaiden is open to questions, and we'll go from there.
Thank you, Mr. Tuma. And I'm just going to start out with one, and sort of general, because we're all going to, or have already, sort of assessed you on our own criteria. But and so mine is rather general, but I just kind of wanted to kind of go inside you just a little bit more than you've already exposed yourself in some ways in your conversation to us. Energy, at least the way I see it, and experience it, quite frankly, at least as a, you know, we're all students of what we are involved in, and in our case, we're certainly both and all involved in this energy thing. Energy, as I see it, is probably the most dynamic and changing thing of any almost any topic that we have before any committee within the Senate, and probably almost any subject matter you can think of. It. We're living in a world of change. We know that. Energy is not going to be the same as it was 20 years ago. And so it increases, I think it just places a tremendous amount of responsibility on the Public Utilities Commission to make decisions which are probably better made there as opposed to the legislature, who would probably either couldn't make them or would not make them well because of the political influences and forces that we work in. I think that's why we have the Public Utilities Commission, to avoid that and to make good, solid, and sound decisions. But so just thinking about yourself and your presence there, what really guides you in many of the hard decisions that you have to make? Where do you go to, and what do you think about as you're making those hard decisions? That's my question.
You know, when it comes to, like, dealing with a tough rate case, I always think about Martha's Bakery in Dundas, small little business. They got to survive. And, you know, your utility bill is a big part of what they do. I think of the gal who works with my son at Quick Trip. You know, she's living in a trailer home with her two young daughters trying to make ends meet. Nobody's running and knocking on her door to put solar panels up on her roof. You know, I'm constantly thinking about those type of people so that they're not left behind. I mean, making sure that people are treated fairly and that we don't just shift costs onto the most, you know, the most vulnerable and the smaller businesses. And that's always in the back of my brain when I come to a difficult rate case, is that's who I'm representing. It kind of goes back to my days in being the legislature. I really want to represent those people that are the salt of the earth. I'm a Minnesotan first, and I think the Minnesotans are wanting to make sure everybody pays their fair share. That's always an attitude. And so that's how I approach those difficult, particularly rate cases or some of those things where people want us to say, oh, XL can pay for it, it's not a big deal. And I realize that, oh, wait a minute, XL is that mom with two daughters. It's Martha's Bakery. Because those costs, XL, there's gonna pass on to those folks. And I wanna make sure that everybody's treated with a great deal of equity. That's the fundamental thing. It really, I actually, when you talk about the law, the history of it, this is really kind of one of those, when I think of this agency, it really fits my personality. I'm very much I always say a prairie populist who is really working for that small businessman, that hardworking employee. And that's kind of the mindset that I bring to it. Those are the people that actually help get this law in place during the Railroad and Warehouse Commission days. And so it's really about making sure that they have a voice, and energy is critical. I mean, mean, you're right. I have a good friend who's a missionary, and he said I was driving down the road one day in my car, and this woman just jumped out in front of me to stop me to get a ride, and that's because I had the energy in my car. I had that $2 worth of gas that she couldn't afford, but she needed to get to town for an emergency. And so, you know, everybody needs energy. All over the world, that concept of energy is so critical to our survival, and we want to make sure that we continue to deliver it to Minnesotans that are cost-effective, and I think most importantly, not just cost-effective, but a reliable fashion. So I'm always driving for that, understanding that this system must be reliable at all times.
Good. Thank you very much. Moving on then, Senator Torres Ray and Senator Rarick's on deck. Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tuma, I don't know how long have you been serving, but I believe that you have been in the commission for some time. So I am wondering if you could tell me a little bit about there is a definition of energy affordability, and you talk a lot about that in your presentation. And nationally, they define that as, you know, for low-income families, kind of the average energy burden, meaning how much does it cost to a low-income family to pay their energy bill? And it's at the national level, we have heard that for low-income families, it's almost 10 points higher as in comparison to a middle-class family. And in some parts, in rural areas in particular, and core urban communities, it goes up to 30%. The burden is as high as 30%. Meaning that a large portion of a family income in a low-income area in rural areas, and I assume Minnesota is one of them because of the weather, or in a residential area that is expensive in urban core can also be very high. Could you talk a little bit about what you know about Minnesota and what is the burden in terms of what families have to pay, and what is your opinion about what needs to be done about it?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Torres Reyes. Yeah, like I said, it really is central to, I think, a lot of what we do. We recognize the inequity that energy can cause. We want to make sure people pay their fair share. We also don't want to leave communities behind. And I think first and foremost, that's why I'm proud of the fact that we are one of the lowest average residential bills in the country, and we take pride in that, and we continue to work towards making sure we maintain affordable energy for everybody. We've made some changes over the last few years in encouraging improvements to our cold weather rule, also to improve position for paying back, particularly through the pandemic, with the leadership of the commission, with Commissioner Sullivan and Commissioner Sieben really led in this area along with others, and I've been very happy to help out in that area where we're trying to make sure that we give them a chance to get back on par. One of the things that we've discovered is that there's really not any more people falling behind on their bill, but those that are falling behind significantly. And so we've been making some adjustments to trying to get them back on a program so that they can get their bills paid, and also to reduce some of that bill and qualify for the programs that are out there. There are several programs that I've been really promoting and working with people like Pam Marshall and those in this space to make sure that they can get the word out that there is assistance both from the state and federal level to start paying their bills. And so we're really working with our utilities to communicate with their customers to know that they can get those bills paid. And that's really been a big focus over the last 2 years. The pandemic has kind of woke us up to that reality. So I hope that answers your question.
Senator Torres Ray, a follow-up. I sense not, so we'll move on to Senator Rarick.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Tuma, I told you ahead of time I had some tough questions for you. So.
Should I go get my bulletproof vest yet? Or is
I appreciate that you admitted you cherry-picked some statistics here to present. And I see that, you know, you say we're lowest in the region and fourth in the nation in residential rates. Where does Minnesota rank regionally and nationally for the industrial rate?
Yeah, and this is where I think it's important to understand the distinction. And I know, no offense, they have a difficult row to hoe in Minnesota, because when we do a rate case, and I'll emphasize this, when we do our class cost of service studies, when you say here's what this utility needs to deliver the service, we have to get to 100% of all the different classes to get there. And because the residentials are doing so well, this unintended consequences of the good work we've done is that it does shift some of those costs onto the commercial industrial. There's just no question about it. But I want to emphasize is that the large industrials are not in the situation where they're paying more than their fair share. They're paying their fair share. It just happens to be the residentials are doing so well in reducing their share. Their bucket is so much smaller because of the good work that we've done. And I know this is always difficult for large industrials in that debate during a rate case. They want to point and say, well, you know, you're giving too much to the residentials and not enough to us. And so that has been a constant debate. Large industrials are well represented. They have their folks there, and they do represent. But the way we've done our class cost of service studies in Minnesota has been amazingly consistent. The history behind it and its precedent, and that's why we're very judicial in our nature. We follow a strong precedent. And in the class cost of service study, we are very consistent. We have been very consistent, whether it's been an independent governor, a Republican governor, or a Democratic governors that have appointed the commissioners. We've all, and has the Department of Commerce and the AG's office arguing in front of us. We've been very, very consistent. The unintended consequences of having a very efficient residential class causes that to be shifted, and yes, what you see is that depending on the utilities, most of our large industrials' bills, which is different than rate, remember we don't always run and look at our rate, and we compare our rate to North Dakota. Well, a mine in North Dakota, you know, delivering coal looks a little bit different than a mine delivering iron ore that has to have large expensive crushers. And so we recognize there's that cost difference, and it's hard to compare bill for bill in that space. But right now, from most of the statistics is that most of our utilities are below the national average, but some are higher. Xcel has been creeping past it, okay? And a lot of it could be, you know, depending on the programs, whatever, that are put in place. Xcel does carry a lot of, as you know, a lot of different programs. And so their rates are usually a little bit higher than, say, Minnesota Power or Otter Tail. And so usually at or slightly above for bills. Now for rates, it could be, you know, you set a target for us of 5% below the national average. I would say some of them have met it, some of them haven't. But they're usually around the national average. They're not the highest in the country. I know that sometimes they like to make you think that, but we do look at that information, and those facts are brought before us in a very judicial manner. And there is a disparity, though if you're a business in North Dakota and you look at what your share is to the residential class, because it's burning more power, you're going to be better off in North Dakota just on that, just hypothetical rate case. There's no doubt about it. We have a system that's efficient, but I guess in my mind, I rather have an efficient system as opposed to an inefficient system. And I think in time, the work that you've done and the work that this committee has done is going to start reversing that as we get more residential folks burning more kilowatts to drive, to heat their homes, and they're going to be happy to do it because their energy bills are going to go down. And so I think in the long run, it's going to be okay, but we're cognizant of that at the commission. We don't ignore it. We don't poo-poo it. I know their lobbyists will say things about us over here because we can't defend ourselves. But now I can, and I can tell you, I'm very cognizant of it. I'm paying attention to it. It's in front of us, and we want to make sure everybody's paying their fair share. That's a foundational principle of the regulatory compact that we oversee.
Eric?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not sure I agree completely with the statements that you just made there. The statistics are out there that show the rates were the worst in the region and very high nationally. just had a meeting this morning discussing this very thing, trying to get them back to where statute says they're supposed to be, that you just stated, 5% below. And although maybe some of their points aren't, that they like to skew the details a little bit as well.
We always like to pick our chair and point to it. Yeah.
I do believe when you look at the details through a lens all the way around, they are well above 5% below the national average. And I think one of those driving factors, we're all aware of the social pressures to move towards renewables, and that is causing us to retire different facilities early. And, you talked about that, that you weigh this out as to who's using what. Well, isn't it the social pressure and thus the residential that are pushing these changes and retiring a number of these facilities earlier, causing these large expenditures to go out? And shouldn't that be reflected when you compare the residential to the commercial to the industrial? And the industrials aren't the ones, and the commercial aren't the ones asking you, some are asking you to go to the renewables, but they're not all. And how is that being reflected as you do the rate cases?
Well, we have to be just cognizant of, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, Senator Rarick. Don't mean to demote you by calling you Commissioner. it does get, we do pay attention to those things. They're not ignored by us. We recognize what they are. We hear the arguments. They're well laid out in front of us in a very contested cases, typically in these rate cases. We don't ask who is responsible for asking to make changes, should we have more renewables on the system? The question that we ask is, which of those customers, what is your contribution to needing more facilities? Residential obviously needs to have a bigger build out of kind of the kind of distribution network. And so they're going to pick up a bigger share of that distribution network than a singular large industrial complex would be, because it's less costly to deliver that bulk of energy. And so they're going to pay quite a bit less on the rate than I would be as a residential. Now, that's different when you compare it nationally. But we're cognizant of that. We don't want to lose businesses. We want everybody to pay their fair share of the utility system. There's certainly opportunities that you folks can have to tell us to do certain things with regards to rates, and we will follow them. We always do, and that's open to us. I will always follow the law and make sure we do it correctly. When you look at the overall system in Minnesota, there are some cost expenses to make this transition, but in the long run, if we do it right, we do it wisely, it will actually reduce rates overall in Minnesota. We will be asking why we didn't do this before, because when the wind blows, thank goodness the good Lord doesn't make us pay for it. We don't have to pay a coal mine out of Wyoming for that energy. It's free, and so we want to use it when it's there, but we also want to be smart. We want to make sure it's reliable and that our businesses have reliable energy. So you need firm, capacitable backup. And so what does that look like? What's the future of that look like? In this transition, we're still figuring out. And one of the exhortations I had to all the parties in the XL rate case is, quit taking sides, okay? We're gonna need all the above, okay? Figure this out. If it's carbon sequestration, if that's the most cost-effective thing, let's do it. If it is a CT unit that's smartly designed, let's do it. If it is batteries and solar backup, let's figure it out. Maybe it will work. I'm not convinced yet, but I want to be open to those things and make sure it is cost effective, it's reliable, and it's clean. And I think if we have those principles in Minnesota, it's a win-win for the state of Minnesota. It's a winner for those farmers who are now the ones we're paying instead of the coal mine in Wyoming. We're paying a farmer for that wind or that solar. And that's circulating back into our economy. And so I think we can find a win-win-win, but we just have to do it wisely and take our time. And that's kind of the way we do it at the commission. It does take a while. I get tired sometimes when it takes 3 or 4 years. I've been working on a decommissioning program for now 3 years to kind of get it in place, and it's finally now in place for our renewable energy sources so that we can make sure landowners and communities aren't left with, you know, stranded assets sitting in their backyard. And so it takes time, but we do it very carefully.
Senator Eric, follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'll just, you know, I think we'll continue to talk about some of these subjects and how we do this. Again, you know, I think as you talked about, you know, the needs on things, and I think, you know, we see, and I think the commission has talked a lot about as well the storage need that's that we need to do. But, you know, I guess I would look at that. You know, a lot of our commercial and industrial load happens, especially the commercial, happens during the day when solar is producing. And it's the residentials that need that storage because it, when they're coming home at night. So I hope some of that is considered as well. And then also you made a comment, you know, about the large industrials have their people that are there. Well, I think we are seeing a growing number of folks representing the other side that are engaging and in much, much larger numbers. And so I hope we're keeping that balance and understanding that balance. Just because 7,000 write in a letter on one side as compared to five on another, that doesn't mean, you know, it just means they're activating a larger base. So that's all I have for right now, Mr.
Having been in the lobbying and the legislature, I hear exactly what you're saying, Mr. Senator Rarick, I do. So thanks.
Thank you. Senator Utke and Senator Matthews is on deck. Senator Utke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Tuma. I've got nothing real serious on this one. I'm looking at your sheet here, and I'm just comparing Minnesota and North Dakota. And if I move my house 90 miles to the west, I save $3.10, but yet the average household goes way down. I'm just concerned about your math. But no, I know it's the average household probably takes into the apartments, right, and all the other different units. The units are different. It's not comparing apples for apples, but I did get a chuckle out of that, so thank you.
You're welcome.
Senator Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Tuma, for being here today. I got to thinking, you know, this is my sixth year in the legislature. I've been on this committee all of those years, so I've nearly made the entire circuit through your entire commission. I think I just have one slot left. That I believe is coming up sooner rather than later. I just want to make a couple of comments. We talked here a bit about the industrial versus residential rates, and I think part of the problem the commission needs to consider is that if the large industrial ends up getting squeezed out, or if they decide that they're more financially viable elsewhere, because I think there are other places in the country that we can point to that would be much more profitable for them. If that were to happen, that would put a tremendous squeeze on a residential. Even your cherry-picked numbers at that point would not be a very good cherry to try serving to the people of Minnesota. And I know you listened to my comments I made in the last meeting and talking about the recent rate case that came out. I won't rehash all of that, but just to say for today's purposes, I see a potential that we're starting to move off track in a way that won't be maintaining these low rates and bills that you mentioned, that all of us have a agreed upon goal we want to keep low. But the recent rate case, the things that the commission has approved, I think there's a lot of weight given to groups that come in with one perspective and not as much weight given to the host communities, to people like me that point to our baseload energy and keep going. Those are really laying a strong foundation right now for our low energy rates, and we don't have a good plan in place for replacing them. I've sat in this committee and have literally told testifiers that have come here, we had a whole presentation once a year or two ago that it was all about things that are coming offline and very little to none at all about what's coming online. I brought up the MISO mix, and our standard baseload energy sources are still on most any given day are still representing about 85% of the generation mix that are keeping the lights on in this building, that are heating our homes at 20 below this winter. And there is a intended shift to move away from the 85% onto the 5 and 10 and 15%. And that's impacted Becker, that's impacting coal plants, that's impacting gas plants. The proposed gas plants are getting smaller and smaller and getting farther and farther away. And I think we're soon coming to a place where the baseload generation that Minnesota will need will just sit outside our borders. They'll get the jobs, they'll get the tax revenue from it. We'll just get transmission lines that come across into Minnesota. And we can pat ourselves on the back that we've got a great mix here in the state of Minnesota, but the effect won't be that different. A gas plant on the Minnesota side of the border versus a gas plant on the North Dakota side of the border will still have the same impact in the local region, climate-wise, but Minnesota should have its share of that mix of having those jobs, of having those revenue, and having that opportunity to create the energy that we need. So I have a lot of serious questions about the path that I see some of our utilities going down, and then some of the approvals that the commission has been granting these. You know, I pointed out in the last hearing that right along with the plan that got rolled out came a request to increase rates by 20% over the next few years. And just my prediction from sitting at this point is that I don't see a path that's not going to have to happen multiple times again in the near future because of the direction that some of our utilities and our generating companies are choosing to go. And we throw around the word reliable and affordable, but what does that actually mean? Is something reliable just because we call it reliable, or is something affordable just because we call it affordable? Or does it come down to the dollars and cents number? Does it come down to making sure that the mix is there, is strong enough, is stable enough? You know, you're well aware that the polar vortexes we've had the last few winters strained the grid to the max. And in response to that, we're continuing to decommission large baseload generation and replace it with non-baseload renewable generation. And that's not a mix for success in the long run. So I'm going to voice that again. I appreciate the service that you've had on the commission. I do think it needs to, we're not that far off the tracks. We can just turn the steering wheel back a little ways before something larger happens. But that's where I foresee our situation from my vantage point. At this point, I'm going to continue to encourage the commission to have that in mind. I think the commission needs to give more equal weight to people of differing sides, because I don't see that happening in today's climate and in some of the recent cases that you've considered, and basically just lay this out for your consideration as we move your process forward. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chair, and Senator Matthews' message heard. I just in response, first of all, as my colleagues will testify in the back, that I'm always looking out for your Becker. They're doing a great job. I think your team there in a very difficult set of circumstances. We do not want to leave our host communities behind, and so I will continue to look out for them. And also on the future, you know, this is my chance. I gave Rick Evans a hard time for for some of the things he said about the resource plan. Here's my chance to throw him under the bus a little bit, and that is when we put in that resource plan that we were going to do a very thorough, what we call track one process for firm dispatchable capacity. That has a lot of meaning that I think was kind of glossed over in the discussion here last Thursday. And that is, this commission is very cognizant of exactly what you're saying, Commissioner Matthews. You're absolutely right. We have to have a very clear direction we're going to go. And so if Xcel is going to say we're going to need something, and when we turn off those coal plants, say in 2027 and 2029, we're going to need firm dispatchable capacity. What is that? It's a theory, you know, everybody kind of knows theoretically what it is. It could be a coal plant, it could be a large hydro, it could be a nuclear plant, it could be a series of CT plants or a CC plant. It could be a lot of things. The question we do with the tier one or the track one type process is Xcel's got to come to us. We're not punting the ball saying, we don't know what it's going to be, it might be a CT. No, we're not doing that. What we're doing is Xcel, step one is you must define what that means for Minnesota and for your ratepayers within the MISO system. That's step one. What is it? Do we need 2 weeks of uninterruptible, dispatchable power that, well, that's going to eliminate a lot of things. If it's got to be dispatchable and ramps fastly, it's going to eliminate probably a second-generation nuke plant. Right now, if that's what they need, and that seems to be what they're saying, they got to prove it through a very challenging, contested case with experts who are testifying on engineering and on system management, all of that. We want to know specifically what is the firm capacity you need, not to find the thing that's going to solve it, which could be a CT unit. What is the need? Do you need 2 weeks of uninterruptible power on and off basis? What do you need? Okay, they have to explain that to us first. That's not punting. That's us saying, you got to go through a very strong contested case process to tell us what that is. And so, it may still be a unit in Sherburne. I don't know. We just don't know what's going to happen in the 2 or 3 years when they have to start filing that information, and it'll take a while to build it. So we're going to make sure we're going to do it right. And so I don't think we want to ignore it. They'll tell you I've been one of the strongest advocates against the CT unit in North Dakota. I think it should be in the Twin Cities. It probably could be right in Becker, but that's not my job. I have to judge that when the facts come before me. But I can assure you we're going to be very aggressive to make sure Minnesotans' needs are first and foremost, and that Xcel knows that. So, but thank you. Your message heard loud and clear.
Okay, members, anyone else? Anyone else, Senator Eric?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's your original term expired in January of 2021. Is that correct?
I believe that is correct, yeah.
Mr. Chair. Yes. When were you officially reappointed to your position?
I believe it was the end of March of 2021.
Okay. Is that right? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
In a law, you can serve up until July, I think.
Yep. Yeah. And so this isn't for you. I think this is more so for the committee to consider. At the end of March last year, which was a budget year, we were deep in consideration of other things, and this really wouldn't be appropriate. So here we are, well over a year after the expiration, and then almost a year after the appointment, before we get to take this up. And we have another position that is expired right now and has not been refilled. When it does, will we have time to look at that? That is our duty as the Senate. We know for 6 years when that term is going to end. I think we should consider shortening the amount of time before that appointment has to be made, probably something more like within 30 days, so that we're not tied up at the end of session and that the Senate can act on that appointment. So nothing to do with you. It just brings out the point that I think we have 6 years to know when these terms end, and we should be acting on them a little more quickly.
and I do deeply appreciate you taking it up.
Point well taken. Senator Newton.
Thank you, and I'd like to follow up with what Senator Rarick says, and perhaps not just for this committee, but for all of our committees when we have appointments. We should look at having a fixed time, 30 days, 60 days, and if, in fact, we don't approve an appointment, that we go into the system that they use in the federal government of a recess appointment, that they're automatically appointed or reappointed. I think it's something that we should be looking at as a body, you know, for all of the appointments that come before us.
I think, Mr. Chair and Senator Newton, for at least the commission, I know it's others, but we serve until you basically remove us, so it doesn't, yeah, so.
So we have a we have an appointment before us. Senator French, any comments you want to make? You've been quite silent. I'm surprised.
I spoke earlier, Mr. Chair. No, I appreciate Mr. Toomey's comments. I come back to our basic mandate, borrowing from Senator Gazelka last year. We're looking for clean, reliable, and affordable energy. The PUC's mission takes that into account. I'm hoping that we get a fair opportunity to talk about clean and the implications. As members of the committee know, yesterday, the United Nations report, which you don't have to buy into, but it's a report, painted a very dire picture, suggesting that we're in even more of a hurry to decarbonize than we thought. I appreciate Commissioner Tuma's discussion of those points. It relates to Senator Matthews' concerns about how we balance those. And I guess, Mr. Chair, that's about all I got for you right now. Thank you.
All right. Senator Chamberlain, you look like you're pondering anything. All right.
Thanks for not taking me down a rabbit hole.
Is there a motion by anyone? I have some suggested language. If there's not a motion by anyone, the chair would move that the committee confirm the appointment of Mr. John Tuma let me just back that. The chair would move that the committee confirm the appointment of John Tuma to serve as a member of the Public Utilities Commission and refer the recommendation to confirm to the Senate floor. And somebody would have to move that if somebody wanted.
I'll move it. Not
offer another motion, please.
I'll move it.
Senator Chamberlain moves that motion. Any discussion on it? If not, all in favor of the motion to confirm and to refer to the Senate floor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Thank you, Mr. Tuma.
Thank you
very much for your presentation today and your answers to some difficult questions. And with that, members, the committee is adjourned.
Oh, he was going to keep us here for a while again.